Well, a very good afternoon to you. From me, Ian Skelly, here to guide you through our programmes this afternoon here on Radio 3, which continue in just a moment with a look at the history and development of the tenor voice. Catherine Bott considers the early years as the voice became more defined, and she's helped along the way by two modern-day exponents, John Potter and James Gilchrist. Then after the early music show, we're going to take a trip to the Bath International Festival, which took place in the summer last year. A particularly wet week in the summer, I remember. Never was Bath better named. But rays of sunshine poured from the assembly rooms in the city, particularly when the violinist Elina Ibrahimova took to the stage to play Partitas by Bach. You can hear that concert at 2 this afternoon. But first, with the time at just after 1 o'clock, this is Ian Skelly with a summary of the news this lunchtime. The government says around 200,000 parents have already opted out of receiving child benefit before new arrangements come into force on Monday. The benefit is being withdrawn from higher-earning families, but ministers have been criticised over the complexity of the new system. Bushfires have swept through parts of southeast Australia, forcing thousands of people to flee their homes. In Tasmania, many people took refuge on beaches and had to be rescued by boat. They are the worst fires to hit the country since 173 people died in the state of Victoria 4 years ago. A colonel in the Nepalese army will appear in court in London today, charged with torturing people during Nepal's civil war. Colonel Kumar Lama is alleged to have committed the offences at an army barracks in 2005. The Nepalese government has complained to the UK ambassador in Kathmandu. Both wings of the Church of England have criticised the decision to allow gay men in civil partnerships to become bishops. Traditionalists say it runs counter to Anglican teaching. Liberals argue that the caveat that it will only apply to celibate men is unreasonable. Pakistan's High Commissioner to the UK has paid tribute to the recovery made by Malala Yousafzai, the 15-year-old girl who was shot by the Taliban. She was discharged from hospital in Birmingham yesterday but will need further reconstructive surgery. Wajid Shamsul Hassan said she was an icon and a role model for standing up to what he called the barbarians who'd attacked her. Labour has called for new laws to cut the amount of sugar, salt and fat in food to tackle rising levels of obesity. It's suggesting a 30% cap on sugar in children's cereal. The managing director of Waitrose has warned that food price inflation will continue to rise for the foreseeable future. Mark Price said last year's extremely wet weather had affected harvests in the UK. And the weather for today, rain arriving into the northwest will spread to the southeast tonight before fizzling out. It'll be locally frosty under clear spells in the north with fog patches. And that's the BBC News and the weather. It's now 3 minutes past one. Next this afternoon, as I say, time for the early music show. And this week, Catherine Bott and guests consider the identity of the voice type we know today as the tenor.
How can I stay when love invites? How can I stay when love invites? How can I stay when love invites? When love invites? I come, my queen, to chase delights. How can I stay when love invites? I come, my queen, to chase delights. Joy with pleasure, I obey. To thee I give the day, to thee I give the day, to thee I give the day. With joy with pleasure, I obey. To thee I give the day.
can I stay when love invites?
The sound of a modern baroque tenor. Not just any baroque tenor. In fact, this baroque tenor is sitting opposite me at a studio in Broadcasting House, grinning away. James Gilchrist, one of our busiest and most acclaimed modern baroque tenors. With him, well, actually it's more a sardonic smile that my other guest is wearing than a grin, is John Potter, a tenor known for his singing with the Swingles in his youth and the Hilliard Ensemble, and latterly as a formidable academic of the voice, author of several books on singing, particularly for our purposes today, Tenor History of a Voice. John, you've come up with a brilliant idea for a running order of how we should work this thing. Instead of starting from days gone by, we're going to start from nowadays, more or less, and go from the known to the unknown. And you've chosen a fascinating example of one of the earliest recorded tenors to start with. Now, why have you chosen Leo Slezak singing Boieldieu?
There are no early recordings of Bach, or very few, by tenors. But as an example of how a tenor might sing, this one has, first of all, he's not singing in the language of the composition. He's not singing always what the composer wrote. He doesn't very often chest his top notes. He doesn't sing in time. So he's just one example of the last thing we know before it goes silent.
Leo Slezak singing in German the aria Viens, gentille dame, from Boieldieu's La Dame Blanche. So come, gentle lady, and actually, comfort ye. That's the earliest phrases in that. Well, because he's singing it in German, komm, instead of viens. It was entirely plausible that he could have been singing the opening section of the tenor role in Messiah, I thought. And a lovely portamento. James,
yeah,
what did you think?
It's so seductive a sound, isn't it? It's very gentle. It's very... And those high, I don't know what they were, the C's or something. the way he just delicately floats up to them without the push that one expects from a modern tenor. It's fascinating to listen to. It really is.
John, what category of tenor was Slezak during his career?
Well, Slezak was one of the most successful Helden tenors.
Hang on.
That doesn't sound like a Helden tenor.
It doesn't, does it? But, I mean, like all Helden tenors before, well, quite well on into the 20th century, they would happily turn their voices to Mozart or whatever.
Yes.
It didn't require the kind of muscular athleticism that modern taste requires. So they were just... Helden tenor was primarily someone who could cope with Wagner, but could also sing anything else.
So Slezak, as obviously we just heard, got lots of the classic bel canto elements, weapons in his arsenal,
yes,
particularly that beautiful portamento, which is nowadays, a century or so later, not such an automatic skill.
It certainly isn't, is it? I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, I do quite a bit of teaching, and I find certainly in terms of teaching people that to develop a portamento as a means of joining notes together is useful, but one should aim, I think, to eradicate it, or at least make it as rapid as possible, and not to be a part of the music.
I think Slezak is demonstrating the archetypical concept,
yes,
of an imagined golden age of singing, because he doesn't welly out,
exactly,
those top notes. I mean, I think I'd ask him to sort of clean up the gliding between notes a bit, but I could easily hear him singing Monteverdi or Caccini and moving me greatly. John, we must move on to another piece of music. You've moved us on the decades a bit in your next choice, because we're going from 1954, and this is to demonstrate another lost art, which is the tenor as improver of some poor composer's music. It's never enough, is it, chaps?
No.
You've got to contribute something of your own.
Thank you.
Well, coming to a TV talent competition near you soon. Quite extraordinary. And did we hear a little edit? A 1954 cut before that very last note? John, what do you reckon?
It's possible. It does sound a bit weird. They're not as weird as what has preceded it.
Yes.
No, hugely, hugely impressive. I think I should just give it a little ident. That was Ecco Ridente from The Barber of Seville by Rossini, but as you'll have spotted, actually sung in Russian by Ivan Kozlovsky.
It is fascinating to hear him doing it his way, isn't it? I mean, he was the king, and, you know, the music on the page can go to hell. You know, that's a vehicle for showing him off. You know, all my colleagues grumble about the fact that singers are no longer the king and these producers and conductors are getting in the way. And that was the golden age when it was the other way round. And he chose what he was going to do and he did it. And my word, you know, three octave cadenza like that, it may not be very beautiful, but it's incredibly impressive.
Mm. Rossini was, I think, one of the first composers who really tried to get his hands on his own music. But the one time when they could really go for it was at the cadenzas, and he certainly wouldn't have dreamt of interfering with that. Similarly with Verdi, when you get to the next generation.
Rossini and Verdi are moving very slightly out of the early music show's comfort zone, or indeed legal remit. But it does remind me of going back to Handel, you know, threatening to defenestrate Cuzzoni because she wouldn't sing what he'd written. So let's sort of claw ourselves back into Handel's generation. And what could singers get away with then?
Well, part of my reasons for choosing Rossini is because it's very, very similar. And singers singing his music, there's very little evidence that vocal technique changed at all between Handel and Rossini, or between Rossini and Masho, actually, if you want to take a wider span. And Handel, like Rossini, would have written specifically for a named singer whose voice he knew. And his task was to write music that would show him in a good light. He would write what he thought they would like to sing, but if they didn't like it, they'd send it back to be redone.
James, you sing a lot of Handel.
I do.
Are you ever aware, when you're singing an aria, of the original personality for whom it was created?
I can't say that. I mean, I know, personally, I know the English oratorio repertoire of Handel much better than his Italian operas. And it's clear to me that there are two sorts of tenor whom he was writing to. There's a much more sort of swashbuckling, heroic figure that might be sort of Judas Maccabeus kind of character, compared to a more lyrical person. And you rarely have the two appearing in the same oratorio. But it's fascinating to hear John talking about the way that the singer was king, because I'm very conscious now that, you know, I want to try and sing exactly what's on the page. And even coming to cadenzas, I think I'm not wanting to embellish beyond what I deem to be tasteful, really. And it's this matter of taste comes very much to the fore. And I think our modern ears want a certain style of Handel performance. And whether that is really what the contemporary audiences at Handel's time might have heard is a very good question. And it's probably not terribly close to how we do it now, actually.
Well, we started the programme with you, James, singing from Handel Oratorio from Esther. And we're going to go on to Handel in Italian opera mode. This is from Tamerlano. What should we be listening out for in the aria Forte e Lieto, John?
Well, I think you could try and guess what's being added to it, and I suspect not very much in this performance, because, well, as James was implying, in contemporary taste, we've all been brought up that a note is a note and a composer writes a score and we then have to reproduce that in some way. Handel wasn't doing that. It was almost the other way around. The singer, in this case Borossini, he was the material and Handel was working with that.
Let us hear not, of course, Francesco Borossini, who was Handel's definitive singer of this role, but a definitive singer of our own day, singing Forte e Lieto from Tamerlano. It's Ian Bostridge.
se ce lassi ai pensier miei della fila il grande amor, se ce lassi ai pensier miei della fila il grande amor. Se ce lassi ai pensier miei della figlia il grande amor, forti e lieto a morte andrei se ce lassi ai pensier miei della figlia il grande. Della fila il grande amor. Se non fosse il suo cordoglio, tu vedresti più orgoglio, io morrei con più valor, io morrei con più valor, se non fossi il suo cordoglio, tu vedresti in me più orgoglio, io morrei con più valor. Ai pensier miei della fine il grande amor, se ce lassi ai pensier miei della fine il grande amor. Se ce lassi ai pensier miei della figlia il grande amor, forti e lieto a morte andrei se ce lassi ai pensier miei della figlia il grande amor.
Ian Bostridge singing Handel from his tribute to three Baroque tenors on CD. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Catherine Bott. With me in the studio today are tenors James Gilchrist and John Potter in strictly alphabetical order there. And we are sort of, well, kind of wrestling with the concept of the tenor in early music history. John, you've devised a scheme whereby we work backwards. If we had been talking about Handel, we've got to talk about Bach. And you wrote a little note last week that this is where the early music tenor parts company with history. Now, James and I are longing to hear what you mean by that.
Well, I make a sort of distinction, really, between the early music movement, which is something that began in the 1970s, and which we're all a part of.
Or possibly earlier. Other decades are available, I think, for that.
Other decades are available. But
but that's another programme.
Yes. Then there is actual history. So the early music movement is the bits we've recovered from history, and history includes the bits that we left behind. So the performances of Handel we've heard have both been wonderfully energised modern performances, and you couldn't fault them, I think, in terms of modern taste. But there are many, many aspects of the 18th century performance that would have been quite different. If you look at the pedagogical literature, you know, we know how these singers were taught. There is constant references to things that we simply don't like and therefore don't do now, like messa di voce, portamento, rubato, and so on. And I can just about imagine these things being applied to Handel, perhaps, but it's almost inconceivable to us now that you could apply it to Bach. So I just wanted at this point to put in a very early Bach recording, which is roughly the same time as the Schlesach we heard earlier. It's not a tenor, because there aren't any tenor recordings surviving, sadly, but it does give you an idea of how, if you apply the pedagogical principles that we know from Tozzi, Agricola, Hiller, and so on, and you apply them to Bach, this is gives you an idea of what Bis Du Bei Mir might sound like.
Now, in modern historical informed performance terms, there's everything wrong with that, because it's not actually by Bach. It's attributed to him once upon a time, but actually by Stölzl. It's sung by a soprano, not the tenor of the subject of today's programme, and it's accompanied on the piano. That was Blanche Marchesi. But as we three sat and listened to it, we were all rather moved, not least by her beautiful trill and the sense of emotion that came over. Now, we've got next John Potter singing Bist du bei mir, accompanied by Tragicommedia. So let's hear that and compare.
Bist du bei mir, ich mit Freude zu sterben und zu deiner Ruhe, zu sterben und zu meiner Ruhe. Bist du bei mir,
John Potter singing Bist du bei mir, accompanied by Tragicommedia. A classic hip performance, John. But
no one's ever called that before.
But and you're not allowed to comment, of course, but James and I were very moved by that.
Yeah,
because
it's beautiful singing, yeah.
In so many ways, for the same reasons as we were moved by Blanche Marchesi doing her interpretation, although it's the opposite. It's informed by the same sort of truth.
I would say, if you will let me...
Yeah, please, please.
That in my case, that was what I would call an early music performance. It has very little connection with actual history. I think the Blanche Marchesi, which is the reason I wanted it put in, does have more connection with history. It's just that that's what the prevailing taste in early music was when I recorded it, and that's how I wanted it to be. And ultimately, it doesn't really matter how you do the piece. You know, if you're committed to the piece... It doesn't matter whether you're...
It's a very good point that you're making. I want to go back one point to your insistence that Agricola's treatise and the writings at the time should necessarily be applied to Bach. I mean, Bach, of course, was mainly a church composer and working with a boys' church choir. And most of the writings of the time were primarily concerned with this terribly exciting stuff floating over from Italy and with opera. And I just wonder whether it's necessarily the case that the thesis of Agricola should be applied to the music of Bach, or whether they really exist in different spheres. I mean, perhaps these days, if one were to go into a modern cathedral and remove all the trebles and put a large diva from the opera stage in to sing sort of Stanford, I mean, is that as silly?
Well, I think now we have a concept of stylistic appropriateness,
yes,
which I don't think would have been the case
no.
in the 18th century. And it's certainly the case that Agricola and Hiller and all those were trying to Italianise German singing and to improve it in that respect.
Yes.
But all the German manuals tend to do that. And Agricola was a Bach pupil.
Mm.
It was all much the same. I mean, just as Blanche Marchese would sing Bach in the same way that she would sing Verdi, I'm sure a singer of Bach's choir wouldn't really make a distinction between opera and church. Mm. Perhaps in quantity, you might be more restrained in church, but by modern standards, not by much, I would say.
And I suppose also, thinking of, I mean, Agricola's treatise, about half of it is about ornamentation, and I certainly find when I'm singing Bach that less is more, by and large. That's what I feel.
Yep.
That it's so well floridly written anyway, that one feels, I'm not sure that I really want to add very much.
Well, it's partly, isn't it, because you are trying to do right by Bach, by the
yeah.
composer, whereas
yes,
the model was reversed at the time.
Okay, yes.
And they all complain about people doing too much ornamentation, and all of these books are about doing less of it. You then look at the examples and think, blimey, if that's less of it, what on earth were they doing?
Yes.
We're going back in time further and also on CD to a tenor whose role in historically informed performance cannot be overestimated, and that, of course, is Nigel Rogers. We're going to hear him singing Possente Spirito, the sort of definitive Baroque aria which demonstrates the power of music, because Orfeo uses this aria to charm Caronte, the ferryman of the Styx, to let him get in the boat and ride over to the underworld. Francesco Rasi was the original singer of Orfeo. John, what was his role? Was back in Monteverdi's time, the birth of opera, before it had all turned sour and got commercialised, and this Arcadian golden age of opera, which lasted for about a decade at the beginning of the 17th century, what was the tenor's role?
Well, the tenor wouldn't have been, I think, conceived as a tenor in the same way that we would now consider a tenor to be a kind of generic voice. So the great singers of the time, who were also composers, people like Peri and Rasi, you know, wrote operas themselves, but they were stars as singers. There's far more documentation, for example, survives about Rasi than does about Monteverdi, because he was what people wanted to come and hear. He was the one that would create the role, and those two versions of Possente Spirito, well, we don't really know why there are two versions, one plain one and one ornamented. It may be the version that he did, it may be a kind of model based on what he did, but he certainly would have ornamented the hell out of it, and not only charmed the underworld, but charmed the listeners, more importantly.
Nigel Rogers singing Possente Spirito from Monteverdi's Orfeo, accompanied by London Baroque. It seems to me that we're hearing there, it's a bit like the great vowel shift. This is the great throat shift. We've moved back historically in music to the first decade of the 17th century, the opening of the Baroque. And Nigel is singing with consummate ease, using for all the embellishments a fast beating of the throat, which is something that is actively discouraged by the time you get to Rossini, I would say. It's not so much an ornamentation question, is it, John and James? It's
a technique question.
Yeah, yeah.
Technique, of course, is very hard to imagine when you can't actually hear it. But with Nigel there, he's one of the few people who can actually sing convincingly with a throat technique, which, if you read the literature, again, the pedagogical stuff, is the sort of thing that they would have been taught to do. One of the reasons it's frowned upon today is that our modern technique is much more sophisticated, let's say, than theirs, and we tend to maximise the sort of acoustic potential of our mouths, whereas they didn't. They, on the whole, if they sang more like they spoke, which they probably did, their larynxes would have been higher. What we do in the modern voice is to maximise the space, the acoustic space in the mouth, by lowering the larynx, and that makes this sort of rich tone. It also means that you can't be very agile. So basically, the bigger your voice, the less agile you're likely to be. It doesn't always apply. I mean, some people, you know, just can do magical things, whatever their vocal disposition. But Nigel is a very good example, I think, of how people might have done that aria.
I mean, I suppose much of what has informed the way people have changed the approach to playing of instruments has been the discovery of old instruments, you know, and picking these things up and making new copies of them and saying, right, this is what they used to play the music, let's try and do it. Whereas, of course, with singers, we've always been using historical instruments. I mean, it's only been a few hundred years. There's surely no difference, actually, in the physical makeup of our voice. And therefore, everything that they could do then, we should be able to do now. And it's only a question of technique. I find that absolutely fascinating.
The singing of Nigel, using largely Monteverdi's own embellishments in that, and that's what Monteverdi wanted, rather than sing, we assume.
Yes. Well, we don't
generally
know.
Generally speaking,
it's something like Razi would have sung, probably.
Yeah.
I mean, there were two published versions, weren't there?
Yeah, there's a plain version.
He was singing more or less the more elaborate version
exactly.
That is published.
Yes, to which he added a few things.
But despite all the elaborations on that recording, the overwhelming impression is that it's the power of the words that Orfeo is singing that's just as important as the power of the notes. And this is something I think we should really move on to, which is, when does singing stop being speech? I mean, how important is our speech patterns and singing like you talk once we get back into the times when there was no such thing as a tenor, really? So here are extracts from Dowland's Flow My Tears. Both of them very surprising performances. Guess who the singers are.
Flow my tears, fall from your springs, exiled forever, let me mourn where night's black sad infamy sings, that let me live forlorn. Dawn vain lights shine you no more.
Forever let me
One of my guests in the studio today, John Potter, singing Flow My Tears by John Dowland with some very creative and grumbly backing from, among others, Barry Guy on double bass. And before that, of course, it was Sting with Edin Karamazov playing the lute and the presence of a very close microphone, don't you think, John?
Yeah, well, I think that, well, first of all, it's his natural way to sing and it's very speech-like, it's very like his speaking voice. And the close mic enables it to balance with the lute. So although we think of it as being very artificial to have close miking, ironically, I think it produces a more natural result.
James, you're famed for the beauty of your lute song. Do you compromise? You work a lot with Matthew Wadsworth.
Yeah, I have done, yeah. The trouble is, I feel that a lot of these songs were written for a very domestic setup. And to sit on a concert stage and perform them is often quite a tricky phenomenon. And I think the question of balance is one that is often comes to the fore, because in order to project the voice to the back of the hall so that people can hear it, you by and large drown out the lute. But I think that question of balance, and John's point about the close mic being perhaps, you know, closer to what might be, that it gives it that sort of domestic feel, doesn't it? That you're almost singing to yourself, which is perhaps closer to how Dowland might have conceived it himself.
Well, going finally backwards and backwards and backwards, we're going into uncharted waters where it's all really guesswork, the Renaissance, the medieval period. And John, you have chosen two final pieces of music from different cultures. Now, are they going to back up the contention that medieval singers were like modern choral scholars? Now, I wasn't a modern choral scholar myself, but I believe both of you were. So, compare and contrast, as they used to say in school.
Well, I think the times produce the singers for the times. And in the voice, for example, of Rogers Covey Crump, you have a high tenor who sings in this with a sort of head voice that's not falsetto. It's not really chest voice. And it perfectly suits to our modern taste. Well, medieval music, among many other sorts. You wouldn't have heard a voice like his, say, 30 years before that, because there wasn't a requirement for the music to have been sung in that way. We can't really know what the original singers of this music would have sounded like, but the chances of them actually sounding like a Oxbridge choral scholar are rather slim, because that is a very specific sort of voice that's been trained in a specific way. One of the things we don't have any evidence for is how these voices were trained, if they were trained at all, in the sense that we understand it.
So we're going to hear Rogers Covey Crump singing an anonymous French song from the 15th century. But to contrast with that, you've chosen, John, for our last music, the voice of Isaac Al-Ghazi singing, well, what?
Well, he was a Turkish-Jewish cantor. And I want us to hear this because it's an example of a tenor voice from a different culture that may not have been quite so different back in the 15th century. This is a very old text and music. It's from the, I think, 12th century. But he sings in a completely different way. And it's just put in there just to show us that whatever we think about old singing, we may be completely wrong.
Une heure
Isaac Al-Ghazi singing 12th century Jewish chant, and before that Rogers Covey Crump with harpist Imogen Barford singing an anonymous French piece from the 15th century, N'a pas longtemps que trouvé Zephyrus. My thanks to James Gilchrist and John Potter. It's been such a pleasure as a mere soprano to be outnumbered by tenors and talk about your voice for so long.
Well, it's been wonderful to be here. Thank you very much.
A final question for both of you. I know how beautiful and eloquent your voices are, whether you are singing or speaking. If you had a choice, if you had your druthers, as they say in America, and you could go back in time in the early music period, which would be your key tenorial repertoire?
That's a very hard question to answer. I mean, I want to do so much of it. I love singing Bach, and I don't know, hearing Possente Spirito makes me just want to be there and grab some of these Monteverdi roles too, because they seem to offer so much scope for the singer.
John?
I'm not at all sure. I'm very
happy.
Why
doesn't that surprise me?
Very happy just doing lute songs. The kind of big singing thing, I don't know, I sort of done it rather.
Go on, you want to release your inner Slezak.
Well, Kozlowski. Yes, that would take me out of the early music. If you have a date, it would rather take me out of your period. I think in terms of technique, it probably wouldn't, but I'm not sure anyone will pay me to do it.
On the early music show, all things are possible, especially with tenors. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
The early music show was introduced by Catherine Bott. Well, the tenor voice became one of the great mainstays of Verdi's music, and if you haven't already heard the fact, you certainly will know very soon that 2013 marks the bicentenary of Verdi's birth. And to mark the event, Radio 3 will be broadcasting all of Verdi's operas over the course of the year. The entire project gets underway on Monday evening here on Radio 3 when John Shea introduces a performance of I Lombardi, the story of two brothers in love with the same woman. It's set in the time of the First Crusade. And the following night, a chance to hear Verdi's story of divided loyalties set against the Sicilian Vespers of 1282. Verdi 200, beginning this week on Monday evening and continuing on Tuesday, both at 6:30 in the evening. Well, we're off to the opera this afternoon on Radio 3. We'll be live at the Met in New York later. An earlier than usual appointment at that great opera house, and for the best seat in the house, because tonight's production is Berlioz's vast score, The Trojans. Deborah Voigt, Susan Graham, Karen Cargill and Brian Heimer are amongst the stars. Fabio Luisi conducts in the pit, and you can hear that live relay from New York this afternoon, beginning at 5 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. Well, stay with us for the music of Bach in just a moment, after a look ahead to a series of programmes this coming week.
What links Marcel Proust's Swan's Way, Apollinaire's groundbreaking volume of poetry Alcohol, Alain Fournier's novel Le Grand Moan, the Cubist movement, and the riotous premiere of Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring?
Stravinsky's music sounded like the creaking of 100 unoiled cartwheels.
Paris, 1913. An important year in the cultural history, not just of the French capital, but of the whole of Western Europe in the early 20th century.
The world's most beautiful city, and is still as fresh and startling now as it was a century ago.
Five big steps in one important year. The essay explores the cultural Paris of 1913. Weeknights this week at 10:45 on BBC Radio 3.
Back to this afternoon now, and normally at 2 o'clock on a Saturday on Radio 3, we repeat Monday's live concert broadcast from our regular lunchtime chamber music recital series at Wigmore Hall in London. But that's on a 2 week break at the moment, which means that today we're going to hear a second instalment of Bach solo violin music, which was recorded at the 2011 Bath International Festival. It all comes from a concert given by the Russian-born violinist Alina Ibragimova, in which she performed four of the six works, three sonatas and three partitas that Bach wrote for unaccompanied violin. Well, last week we heard two of the sonatas. This week we've got two of the partitas, or suites, to enjoy. Alina begins with the partita number 2. It's in D minor, and it's perhaps the best known of them, or rather the one that contains the most famous piece, that being the great Chaconne, 64 ingenious variations on a 4-bar descending chord sequence. Well, that movement is the last of the five. Before it come 4 dance movements, an Allemande, a Corrente, a Sarabande, and a Gigue.